My name is Karen Blomquist, and along with my husband Bill Strelo, we will be leading this session on The Church Goes Public Through Community Organizing. Yesterday, in a very basic, general sketching kind of way, I tried to lay out some of the reasons. Pardon?
Chipmunk just came in.
Anyone's welcome. Tried to lay out some of the basic theological reasons for why we do need to think far more than we have as to why the church needs to go public, and began to sketch out some of the reasons, although it was by no means exhaustive, as to why it's been difficult for us to think that way. You know, we've tended to separate the church off here from the public or political or economic arena. And we'll want to come back to some of those theological issues and ethical principles, perhaps later on this hour, but especially tomorrow when we try to put this all together. Most of what we want to do today, however, is to look at one example of how the church goes public, namely through an example of community organizing that Bill has been involved in, and that's actually been written up in a book that's available in the bookstore called Activism That Makes Sense. And Activism That Makes Sense, he has it here, by Gregory Pierce. And after he lays that out, I want you to be aware of, okay, what are some of the pivotal issues that this raises for the church? Because I think community organizing as a strategy becomes a very helpful example of how the church becomes public, but it also raises a lot of issues for discussion that we in the church have not been that used to discussing. Issues like power, self-interest, values of a community, and probably a host of other kinds of issues. So I'm going to basically turn this session over to Bill, who will be sharing from his own experience and involvement in this.
This is the book that Karen referred to, subtitled Congregations and Community Organization. My comments are going to be what I want to refer to as pastoral reflections out of an experience with a congregation I served in Queens, New York, that was involved in a community organization called the Queens Citizens Organization. And I'll do that, and along with that, some biblical theological reflections, at least about what I learned. How many of you are familiar with Queens as a borough of New York City? That's right. And it's Archie Bunker's home turf. Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, and the Bronx are commonly referred to amongst the residents as stepchildren or the outer boroughs of Manhattan. You think of New York City, you think of Manhattan. But Queens is more or less a working class community. It contains the people that populate Manhattan. As a matter of fact, someone made a study and determined that the entire population of the city of Chicago goes in and out of Queens, Brooklyn, and Bronx into Manhattan every day on the subways. So it's the nucleus where New York City gets its employment, its people. And New York, or Queens then, is made up of churches, synagogues, schools, racetracks, bars, restaurants, etc. And in 1978, I was interviewed and eventually called by a congregation in Southeast Queens, just north of Kennedy Airport, a black congregation, which in the call interview asked me a question that I'm glad I was sitting down, or otherwise I would have fallen down. They asked, if we call you to be our pastor, will you work with us in the political and economic renewal of our community? And I said, of course, and because I wanted the call, and I also meant it, and eventually they did call me. And we began to move into that community and recognize that as a neighborhood, Southeast Queens, fell under what the city had labeled planned shrinkage. And they did that because of the airport, which immediately surrounded the area. Planned shrinkage simply meant that neighborhood essentials were taken away. The police district was moved, a fire station was closed, schools were closed, streets were not worked on. In other words, the vital community services that were crucial to the neighborhood were taken away. Plus, there was the expansion off airport of the air freight industry. You've seen these advertisements on TV, Emory, Percolator, etc. Well, all those found that rents on the airport were too expensive, so they began to expand off airport. And the way they did that was they went to the realtor who had put up some single family dwellings and expressed their interest. And this realtor then bought back the land and erected air freight industry houses, warehouses. And this was happening within a community that had gone through racial transition very well. St. Peter's was a congregation that was 50 plus years old about this time. This was in the mid-70s, and found itself almost overnight surrounded by these air freight warehouses. And of course, being surrounded, the air freight communities wanted the land on which the church building was located. So they began to negotiate with the congregation, saying, we'll buy the land at $7 a square foot, which in New York City is ridiculous. It's worth at least 15 to 20. That was, you know, 15 years ago. And so the congregation said, no, we'll sell you the parsonage, but we won't sell you the land for the church. Well, one Thursday evening before Palm Sunday, the building was completely burned to the ground. And the fire department came and determined that it was arson. So St. Peter's congregation was without a church building. They leveled land and turned it into a parking lot and rented it out at $25,000 or $30,000 a year to this one air freight place that was trying to buy the land. Never was there any connection made who really burned it, but had no place to worship. Eventually went to a school. And the planned shrinkage syndrome even came from the mouth of the bishop, because the bishop said, well, there's really no community here. So we don't think there should be a St. Peter's church. So why don't we just close up St. Peter's and you can merge with another congregation? Well, they said no, they didn't want to do that. They felt that there needed to be a vital mainline denomination in that community. That was their self-interest. That's what they wanted to rebuild on. They were not to be content with the patient endurance that the bishop said they ought to have. So when I came there in 1978, I recognized that alone, the congregation really could do nothing. A friend of mine said, really, the congregation had lost. And then one evening I attended a pastor's meeting and a community organizer from this Queen Citizens organization plus a Roman Catholic nun were there to talk about QCL. Well, many people had heard of QCL and thought it was a rather redneck organization, a white organization within Queens looking after its own interests. But we also recognized and had heard that it was trying to solicit black churches in terms of its membership. And so the organizer and this nun began to talk with me and eventually began to talk with other members of the congregation about joining QCO, which at that time was trying to become a large-based organization, large and broad-based organization throughout the borough of Queens. At that time, they had 25 or so Protestant and Catholic organizations, attempting essentially to gain power for their member congregations. And one of the things that QCO began to identify the church as, not in a theological way, but in a sociological way, was to begin to think of the church as a network of families who have values and who have money. And therefore, a network of families with money who can create power. And what community organizing is all about in many respects is just the raw access to power, power in the political arena. Well, our issue in Southeast Queens was the airport. We didn't like the airport encroaching upon our community. We soon discovered that also became the issue for the borough. Here was St. Peter's congregation, 40 people, not 40 families, mind you, but 40 people struggling to rebuild a congregation. And suddenly we discovered that our small issue was the key to, if you want, making QCO. Because we realized that Kennedy Airport was the key to the economic revival of New York City. Remember that New York had defaulted on its bonds, defaulted here and defaulted there. But studies showed that the key to the economic recovery of New York City was the airport. 20% of the population of Queens was employed directly by Kennedy Airport, and 20% plus of New York City was employed either directly or indirectly by the two airports, which were in Queens. So we recognized that that was the issue to build the organization on. So we moved beyond the neighborhood and beyond a single issue for a congregation into a multi-parish issue, which basically built the organization. I'm going to skip here a little bit. What did that do? What did that do for us as a congregation? I think at least four things. It moved us beyond our own narrow little community, moved us beyond race, beyond class, beyond religious persuasion, and beyond an economic base. What the organization tried to do was saying, if citizens, average citizens, are going to have any impact at all on the public arena in New York City, they have to cross the lines that the city, and in this case, Mayor Koch had set up. Now, any of you know about Mayor Koch? He's a classic race baiter, pitting white against black, against Hispanic, Protestant against Jew, against Catholic. Well, what QCO was trying to do was to eliminate those lines that people had been separated by. So here was an organization, eventually when I left, it was 58 congregations strong, that was cross-race, cross-class, cross-religious, and cross-economic lines. And folks began talking with one another. And what did we do? We recognized that if the key to the economic revival was Kennedy Airport, that we had to know something about who runs this airport. And it's not the city of New York, but it's the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which has assets of about $4 billion, staff of 8,500, and some of the best legal experts from both New York and New Jersey. And we also recognized that we somehow needed some political allies, somehow somebody who is going to get us in the inside. And that person happened to be the then lieutenant governor, and now governor of New York, Mauro Cuomo. And reason for that was very simple, because he was a political enemy at that point of Ed Koch. Ed Koch wanted to run for governor again, so did Mauro Cuomo. So Mauro Cuomo became an ally of the organization, basically steering us in the right direction as how basically to handle the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey. And I can remember at one meeting, we had assembled some of the best leaders, the key leaders of the city and of the state, the lieutenant governor, the head of the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey, the head of the economic development for New York City, about 10 people. And basically had a meeting. And someone said, well, do you think we should meet again? And Governor Cuomo stood up and he said, just a minute, that question is premature. You don't realize who you're talking with. These people will not go away. They mean business. And essentially what Cuomo did was give the organization power, simply saying, if in fact there's going to be a community organization in the borough of Queens, i.e. New York City in this case, this is it. This is the organization that's going to be the actor in the public arena. And simply said, if you really mean business, QCO, you come up with a document that's clearly thought out to tell us how the two communities, the airport community on one hand, and the residential community the other, can live together, because neither of them are going away. Well, the airport community was completely livid at him for that. But that's part of Cuomo's style. He's also always trying to get people involved in acting, at least in the city of New York, and I think you see him doing that now as he's governor. So we came up with a proposal, which took about 2 months after careful research and study to present. And it was ignored by the Port Authority. It was going nowhere. People were spending nights upon nights every week studying the Port Authority. Our people knew more about the Port Authority than they knew about themselves. Eventually, when things got bogged down, the controller of the city of New York, who was up for re-election, Harrison Golden, said, I think I have something of interest for you. Is that the Port Authority was renegotiating the lease on the airport, seeing the Port Authority runs the airport for the city of New York in lieu of paying taxes on the World Trade Center. Port Authority owns the World Trade Center, but doesn't pay any taxes on that. So in lieu of paying taxes, they lease the airport. That the Port Authority was renegotiating its lease, which was to expire in something like 2017, and they're renegotiating it in 1980. Well, it turns out that if you began to read the lease and began to research what was going on, that the Port Authority was essentially cheating New York City out of millions of dollars a year, but they were keeping that hidden. And the reason Harrison Golden wanted that discovered and brought out is that the late borough president, Donald Manus, of Queens, wanted to run for controller. And in retrospect, why Manus committed suicide in terms of all the monies that were going on, QCO is onto something it really never knew about. So here was one politician playing off against another politician and saying, this is the issue you want to look at. Well, eventually what happened was that QCO essentially stalled the lease for a year. Till just before I left, the Port Authority and QCO negotiated an agreement for approximately $15 million, $2 million a year over the next 7 or 8 years for the airport community and the residential community to work in cooperation as to how the airport expands. That was the sole issue, is that how can two communities, airport and the neighborhood community, live together in harmony? Some would say, well, you have to just say that the airport community has to go. Well, that was ridiculous. It meant jobs to many people, including people in my own parish, people in our own community. What the community recognized is that it could, in fact, learn how to be an actor in the public arena. And that was quite different from what it had been used to. I think there are at least four or five situations where churches predominantly act. One is that they tend to act in terms of social crisis. They respond to activity, food pantries, what have you. Secondly, is they urge their congregants or parishioners to become involved individually in individual political action. Thirdly, they urge people to become involved through the making of resolutions. Now, how do resolutions really impact or change anything? And lastly, they suggest that people become involved in electoral politics. And I think the fourth one was the one that was the bugaboo that we most disliked in New York, is that we discovered that it's really not the politicians who were running the city of New York, that we could hold accountable. But in fact, it was what was called the permanent government. I'm sure that's true in most other major cities or communities, that it's the politicians that are there, but they're really not the ones that you can really hold accountable. What about the people who are running the port authorities? What about the people who are running the big corporations with whom the politicians are in constant conversation? What we were trying to do as a group of congregations was to say that we, 55 congregations, approximately 55,000 families, once you start counting these big Roman Catholic parishes, can be actors in the political arena. And in order to do that, we need an umbrella. We need an organization. And that organization is called QCO. I'll stop there. Karen's got some things to say, and then maybe we can have some discussion.
I don't want to add too much to what Bill has said. Maybe just to accent one thing. I don't think he accented that much. This coalition of Protestant and Roman Catholic parishes was primarily a coalition of Lutheran and Roman Catholic. And so it certainly was a case of a vast number of Lutheran congregations. It wasn't just his congregation. So some of the stuff we were saying yesterday about the quietism of Lutherans was definitely a different kind of thing that was occurring there.
But a postscript to that, it was predominantly Black Lutheran congregations.
Right,
who bring another tradition in terms of church and community than most.
And for whom political social involvement is much more taken for granted. The three kinds of issues that I suggested at the beginning that I think are the questions that I'd like for us to ponder, and I really want this to be a common kind of discussion on these issues, are the issues of power, self-interest, and values. Let me start with the last of those first. What is really essential in the kind of model of what QCO is about and what a number of other community organizing efforts around the country are about is beginning to organize around some of those very basic values of people and their yearnings for a sense of community, for good work, for good schools, some of the kinds of values that, oh, some folks say on the left might at times poo-poo and say, oh, well, you know, these are kind of the mother and apple pie kinds of values or whatever. But beginning by taking those issues very, very seriously. And it's related very much to what I was saying yesterday about that essential strategy of moving from an immersion in what it is that's really bugging people, their pains, their aches and groans and all the rest, the point when the church has rushed in and tried to be pastoral in the face of that pain. But then moving with those values and saying, okay, in what ways are these values being undercut? And what are some of the forces and dynamics in this community that are challenging those values? And therefore, at a very beginning level, doing some social analysis that begins to make some connections between those values, those yearnings that people really hold dear, and some of the wider kinds of factors that are impacting upon that. So I think that's, to me, one of the important learnings from community organizers that I think church folk need to take much more seriously, is how do we run with those basic values rather than kind of riding roughshod over them and saying, well, you know, you've got to be for this and this and that, but connecting with those basic yearnings of people. And in the case of Queens, that meant connecting with some values that more often than not played itself off in some stereotypical Archie Bunker kinds of political views or some racist kinds of patterns. And yet, as Bill's laid out, one of the keys of the organizing that went on is that there was a cutting across that. And all of a sudden, the woman from the racist community not too far from us, who was a solid Republican, a conservative Republican, found herself leading a group where some of her main supporters were the Blacks who lived, across the highway from where she lived, and that kind of connection that emerged because of those common values. A second issue, namely that of self-interest, is one that I think we need theologically to think about far more deeply than we have. Most of the time in the church, we emphasize self-sacrifice, concern for the other, and therefore condition folks not to take their own self-interest very seriously. I think one of the primary contributions of feminist theological thought and a number of other liberation theologies that are emerging in our own days, in our own day, is recognizing that self-interest per se is not necessarily a bad thing. If anything, we need to hear more deeply that biblical witness of loving others as we love ourselves. Certainly self-interest that separates us from others or sets us in a competitive, alienating relationship to others is something that I think we as a church need to challenge. But what becomes the case in community organizing models like this is that self-interest becomes the jumping-off point that enables us then to connect with some others whose self-interests might be somewhat different, but where there's some points of connection. For example, in the borough of Queens, the self-interests of folks in the northern part of the borough, most of whom were white, might initially be defined a bit differently than the self-interests of folks whose communities were literally being eaten up by the air freight industry. And we could share some really gross kinds of examples of that. For example, the air freight executives would come barging, you know, driving through town in their Lincoln Continentals, and the kids would be walking across the street in the crosswalk, as one was doing in front of our house one day, was hit by the executive. And the way in which the powers that be in that community were stacked against the residents became very evident when, first of all, it took the police and the ambulance 20 minutes to get there. And when they got there, the executive sat in the squad car, and they were laughing while the kid was still waiting for medical attention. And the community became a bit embroiled about that, to put it mildly.
And the next time that happened, they called and said a police officer had been shot.
And then they got immediate attention, yes, yes. But that's a little bit of a diversion. But what became essential in the organizing effort was to help folks in the north part of the borough to realize that the economic powers as epitomized in not only Kennedy Airport, but LaGuardia Airport, together were a powerful influence that needed to be addressed in a concerted kind of effort. And so all of a sudden, the self-interests of folks in the north part of the borough and of folks in the south part of the borough, those who were white predominantly and those who were black and all the other kinds of diversities, began to connect with one another. And that was certainly key in terms of building the organization. The third aspect that I think we need to think about far more deeply than we have is the whole nature of power and the fact that we in the church have had a very negative notion of what power is all about, you know, unless we're talking about spiritual power or some kind of power with a religious kind of adjective in front of it. And I think this is where, whenever we try to talk about the model of community organizing with church folk and with future pastors at the seminary, some of the more interesting discussions emerge, because we quite frankly get pretty shy when we talk about power. And we say, well, we don't want to get our fingers dirty and all of that. But a power that is able to enact or empower others, rather than the kind of power that is a control over kind of thing, is, I think, a very biblical understanding of what power is. And therefore, I think we in our churches and in our discussions, including in our discussion here, I hope, can begin to talk about what it might mean for the church to see itself as having some power. Now, certainly some of the ways in which community organizing sees congregations as having power are ways that I have to kind of, I bristle a bit and say, well, no, the church is more than just a network of families and money. But at the same time, I can't deny that that's part of what we're dealing with in terms of the institutional reality of what the church is. So it's a matter of thinking through some of these categories and saying, okay, is that compatible with how we see what the church is all about? If not, at what points does there need to be some critique? At what points do we need to learn from what this particular model of the church going public is all about? So let's open it up at this point, and whether some of you have some thoughts that you'd like to throw in at this point about those three things of value, self-interest, and power that I've just laid out, or some of the other things that Bill has been talking about, the floor is open.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I learned more about base communities from QCO than I learned by reading all the books. And all what Karen was saying was involved in that. We were going to identify something we're going to do. For instance, this particular meeting with the Lieutenant Governor and all the people. That was role played for over 2 weeks as to who those people were going to be. We had briefing sheets on each and every one of them, where they came from, where their power base in the city and or the state was, the connections that they had with one another. Prior to that, the organization did what's called a power analysis, where lines are drawn from people to banks to institutions to see how connections were made. And then the action itself took place. And we did not expect Cuomo to stand up and do what he did. As a matter of fact, when people went around and one person announced that he was executive director of the Alinsky Institute, Cuomo just bristled and wrote Alinsky in letters that could be seen across the room. Following that was an evaluation. How did it go? What are your feelings, first of all, to everybody there? Not what did you think, but what are your feelings? The thinking came later. And I think that was very important throughout the 4 years that I was involved, particularly, and Karen will talk about this a little bit later, in terms of manners. What can a group of Christians who are acting out their role as citizens, and I want to clarify that, we never acted as a group of churches. To do so was to, you know, violate a lot of standards, also get yourself into tax problems, but as a group of citizens, was the Queen's Citizens Organizations. One of the issues raised was ridicule. Do you ridicule people? Can Christians ridicule? Particularly, can you ridicule Mayor Irving Koch? Well, it turned out that no, we decided we didn't want to do that. He was an example of ridicule personified. We weren't going to do that. Some people said we should really make a fool out of him, laugh at him. And then people got talking about, well, do you really like it when people laugh at you? No, we really don't like when people laugh at us. So yes, there was that pre-planning, which was intense. There was the action itself, and there's always the evaluation. And the evaluation was always done immediately following the event, not 10 minutes later, but immediately following it. And then, of course, it was drawn out into the next ensuing days or weeks. But tried to do it in as intentionally biblical a way as was possible. You know, first of all, what are you learning about yourself in this? What are you learning about conflict within you? Because all conflict, as far as I'm concerned, begins with the self. And therefore, if you can come to grips with that, how does that change your role as a human being, as a citizen? If QCO had achieved nothing in its campaign with the Port Authority that could be pointed to as pragmatic, what it did change was the lives of individual people who felt empowered. I can remember a member of our parish, a fellow who had his general education diploma and was a dispatcher for a bus company. Meek and mild when I first met him, knew the Bible well, But at one point, he was leading a meeting with the vice president of the Port Authority with over 2,500 people. He was empowered. It changed his life. The fact that it was a successful campaign for the Port Authority was to Marion incidental. But he was changed, and his view of himself was changed, and his view of his relations with his family and his community were changed. Because he had to constantly deal with the conflict within himself. And I think that Dorothy Zola, in this book, Suffering, has a fantastic chapter on language and suffering, which I just look to in terms of some of my learnings. She says it's basically three stages that people deal with suffering and their expression of it. And this was certainly true in my congregation. At the earliest stages, people are mute. They're isolated from each other, and they're powerless. We knew that there was a problem in Southeast Queens. Everybody in Southeast Queens knew it. But people burrowed themselves into their homes. These were single-family dwellings. People who had come from the Bedford-Stuyvesant, but come from Harlem or come from the Caribbean, and also were a lot of tension between American blacks and Caribbean blacks, would for the first time in their family's history or their generations own homes. So they burrowed themselves into their homes. They were isolated, they were powerless, they were mute. They couldn't really talk about what was the problem. But as they began to talk about that individually, and I think here is where the Protestant technique of the individual pastoral call is so important, you know, to the home, they began to talk about that. And I began to hear that each person had a problem that develops into an issue. They began to lament. Now, it is awful. We are being persecuted. Our kids are being hit by these cars and by these trucks. At this one meeting with the Port Authority, Peter Goldmark, who was one of Kennedy's big campaign people, said to me, he said, "Well, I am concerned when young people are hit by cars." And somebody shouted out, "Well, we are outraged." Moved, this lament was expressing itself as communicated speech. Within our worship service, our prayers began to change. No longer was it for some distant thing, because for the here and now, deliver us from these 18-wheeler trailers. And people began to connect the wheels of Pharaoh's chariots with the wheels of these air freight trucks. But people began to say that we can accept and we can have conquest within the existing structures. Then they began to get involved in this organization called QCL, and they began to see that change can take place, and the theological umbrella began to change and say, we live within a world where God is assertive. We live within a world that can be changed. We don't have to live within the existing structures, but through this solidarity that we have within ourselves to begin with this conflict, with the solitary, with the other person, be he black, white, or she be Republican. I think one of the neatest things I ever saw was this one Republican woman struggling at a meeting with the Transport Workers Union of New York, which everybody hates, because it's a black union to begin with and because they're strong, but we're feeling the pinch through some of this airport controversy by saying, can Christians, Roman Catholic Christians, she was a Roman Catholic, can they really mix with people who I think have the same values as I do in terms of my family? And then creating new structures. So, this whole thing is, yeah, to get back to your question, pre-planning, constantly dealing with this stuff, dealing with it in terms of biblical imagery, the action itself, and then the evaluation. What have we learned from it? And where do we go from there?
Could you talk a bit more about how the gospel, you know, how you based your action on gospel values? Did you start out thinking this way? Or did it eventually, at what point did it become a question of gospel values? We don't have to live this way.
My experience was that if it was imposed that you should love these people, if I could say to Marion DeScott or Will Lawrence or people in my parish, no, you've got to go love the Pat Ottenfelds in Regal Park. They said, that's blue. You know, she doesn't love me, I don't love her. We were opposed. But what happened was, once they began to live with one another, almost on a weekly basis, they began to discover all these proclamations that preachers such as myself want to give them, that they have something in common, that it's important that they couple with one another. Or that's what I understand by self-interest, is coupling with the other. So the gospel values were discovered, if you will, in community. They weren't imposed. They say, you have to do that. This would be the nice thing to do. That's some of my critique about churches saying you should get involved in politics. Well, with who? I mean, should I just do that by myself? Does it make any sense, the solitary individual getting involved in a political campaign? But these people learn together this problem of the permanent government in New York City. That sometimes it's futile for churches simply to say you should be involved in electoral politics. What they found themselves involved in was politics. They became less reactive and more proactive. And to me, that's a gospel value. God is not reactive, God is proactive. And therefore, what's my point? That God is assertive. That they live in a world that can be changed. They live within structures that can be changed.
Well, during your meeting, as the 58 churches together, are their leaders, or however, was there a prayer time?
Mm-hmm.
Reflecting time?
Mm-hmm.
And there were amazing worship celebrations at periodic times too, you know, special events that were these incredible, I think we've probably all been to some kinds of ecumenical worship experiences. Well, these had a kind of grist for the mill there, because, you know, they were not just people, you know, gathering, saying, well, we share some common beliefs, but it was some common actions that then made that common faith more meaningful. The other thing that Bill, you didn't mention, is in the back of this book is a document called The Biblical Imperative, which Bill and some others helped to write, which became a kind of theological statement that emerged during the life of the organization, when it became very, very apparent that rethinking some of those biblical connections was important. And therefore, you know, to pick up on the comment about base communities, it was a very similar kind of theological method that people were engaged in. Theology as that second step reflection in the midst of praxis. And so in that case, it was very key. At the same time, though, what was important about this, and I think there's a number of ways in which QCO is different from, say, the organizing of DMS in the Pittsburgh area, but one of the key differences is that it definitely was a lay-led group. In fact, there are some almost nasty comments that Greg Pierce has to make about in his book about clergy types, and especially about academic types who would try to tell folks how they should do their thing. So it really was that empowering of laity. And it was, I happened to be visiting Bill's church one Sunday. I was serving another church in Brooklyn, which, by the way, was on the edge but not actively involved in another very interesting organizing effort that resulted in the building of a lot of housing for low-income people in East Brooklyn. But I was there one Sunday when one of his parishioners really got up and made a testimonial about how he really had become emboldened to speak out, and to, you know, he had gotten more involved in his union leadership as a result of his involvement in this community organization. So it really was a kind of empowering and training of laity that this was a part of.
I'd like to address or raise a question about the issue of interest. It seems to me that in this particular example, and another example that I'm familiar with is during the Vietnam War period, the coordination of action by churches, you could fairly easily identify a common interest which could unite a very disparate community. It seems that for many of us, the situation is that our church is, our congregations themselves will share a wide range of interests which, by any objective analysis, often conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to find something where there would be a common interest, and in fact, if you look too closely, you could find lots of things to divide rather than to unite. I think this is particularly true in suburban churches, or if there is a common interest, it's an interest that we may not appreciate very much, which is to maintain the situation much as it is right now. How do you deal with that sort of thing?
The issue that was the common one of self-interest was broadly family. And I think that that's an interest that people bring to hold on. Family. What are the forces in society, and you can become one, just mild rhetoric now, what are the forces of society that are impacting upon families, destroying families? Paul Simon was talking last night about the media. Well, yes, but is there a way to organize against the media? Now, one of the things we left out here is before all this action took place, families of congregations, and congregations paid early on anywhere from $250 a year to $6,000 a year to this organization because it paid staff organizers, and when I left we were paying $1,000 a year. But families were encouraged to go to a 7 or 8 session meeting dealing around apathy. Basically, is that why are families apathetic? And Greg Pierce makes the comment in the book, most clergy will say people are apathetic. What they mean by that is that they just don't believe in the issues that clergy think they should believe in. and I think he's right. But basically, what the broad-based issue was family. In Southeast Queens, what was impacting the family was the air freight industry and all the accumulated effects of that, like drug traffic. And talking about another example, there was a telephone on a particular corner that was being constantly used by drug pushers to make their deals. And the community said, we'd like that telephone removed. And they say, well, that's one of the highest rated phones in the Southeast Queens. It's on, it's being used. We can't do that. It's making money for us. They said, yeah, the drug pushers are using it. So time and time again, some men from the community would go out and sniff the line. So finally, they just got too tired of repairing the phone, so they took it out. Now, that raises the question of manners. Should Christians do that? Should go and destroy property? So what the self-interest question was one of family. And every time the group met, either in local congregations or as an organization, talked about that. You know, what is happening in our society? Basically, if I can use Pat Ottinger as an example, if one of the preachers had gone in and tried to convince Pat Ottinger that a certain politician was really doing a disservice to her family, she wouldn't have believed it. It would be pure rhetoric. Leftist rhetoric, a liberal talking. But for Pat Ottinger to come from that conservative secretary of a Roman Catholic parish to the head of this, you know, 26,000 plus family member organization was incredible, what she went through. She came out believing and acting the same way I did, but I never talked with her about those things. She learned that on her own, because she found it was in her full self-interest to do so. So self-interest and altruism are in dialectic with one another. And selfishness is not to be confused with self-interest. As I understand all self-interest, it's the coupling with one another. I can only get for myself, from you, what I want if I enter into dialogue with you. I become part of your community and you become part of my community. And I think that for me, I won't say I think, I know that for me was the key to the gospel values, is that people began to couple with one another. And you mentioned about the worship service, they were moving toward having Eucharist, and I think Bishop McGovern would have looked the other way on that one. And my bishop, the Lutheran bishop, at first was totally opposed to this thing. Totally. I mean, he just went crazy. But then, through 2 or 3 year period of having lay people going and talking to bishop, not just clergy, but lay people, he came around to endorsing it. In fact, it's in the book. But as Karen mentioned, I think what was so important, at least politically, was it was a lay-led organization, and it was old. You know, we had people 75 years old in this thing, taking prominent speaking roles. It was cross-race, and the clergy was also a mix of ages. Because one of the things we found that politicians and government can really do, if it's all clergy-led, kill it. That's what happened in Pittsburgh. And it was all young clergy in Pittsburgh, too. Easily impressionable. But in New York, it wasn't. You had some of these older priests, you know, who knew Bishop McGovern from seminary. So it was just a good thing.
Yeah, I think just another thing on that self-interest thing, I think we need to be clear that that can be a long, arduous process of sorting through those interests. You know, it's not just a matter of going with what the initial presenting self-interest is, and that's where some carefully developed, well-researched social analysis of, you know, what is impacting that self-interest. You know, it was certainly not immediately evident that looking at the airport and the powers that control the airport was key to what was affecting their self-interest. You know, that was a long kind of process. And one of the basic organizing principles that Pierce lays out here is, you know, if we're going to work in these coalitional ways around certain self-interest concerns, there are certain controversial self-interest matters or controversial issues that we avoid. And that's where, you know, I have problems with that because, you know, I'd say, well, there's some issues that are very basic. You know, he basically said, well, you know, stay away from abortion, stay away from this, because you're not going to build coalitions around those issues.
You avoid them at a certain time.
Yeah.
Right. If you try to build an organization, Roman Catholics and Protestants, you don't tackle abortion as your first issue.
I just want to ask about unpacking the word family. Does that... I'm assuming that in an urban situation that includes various kinds of things.
Yeah. Families, friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, early on that was an issue because people didn't like family. They said, well, there are a lot of single people in this organization too. So who do you couple? Who are your friends? How is that? Now, you want to live in Manhattan? Well, you can't live in Manhattan. Mayor Koch says you have to be bringing home at least $40,000 a year to bring you to Manhattan. So he's pushing all people into the outer boroughs.
But I think going back to the organizing thing, it takes a lot longer time to help get the people into things. And you feel the imperative of time, and I think a lot of pastors have sort of guilt laid on them that they're graded on how effective they are on the obvious side. But, you know, if you really sit, think about it, if you can sit back and play the role and help people do all this, that you, and as they go, then the strength is there. So that basically, how well, you should be rated, evaluated on how well you aren't visible in the process, rather than how visible you are.
That's right.
And that was the biggest difficulty for those of us who are clergy, is that we were told, don't give the interview.
See, all of you should take social group work records.
That's right. Well, I agree.
I want to talk some more about that very word effectiveness tomorrow, because I think we tend to veer in two opposite directions on that. Either we say, oh, well, we are totally ineffective, and, you know, the church is not called to be, you know, in the world, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's certainly some truth to that, but I think sometimes we overlook those ways in which we can be effective. I mean, basically, the story that Bill laid out is a story where an issue that was identified and very definitely in the self-interest of the 40 people that were a part of this small, struggling congregation that was supposed to die according to the synod guidelines, their issue became the pivotal issue around which these 50-some other congregations and members and then some unions also began to organize around, which resulted just before we left in a $25 million settlement with the Port Authority. The idea being that that money was to be used for redeveloping that community, for the needs of that community, which had many needs simply because of the devastation that had been wrought by the developments connected with the air freight industry. So, I mean, that, you know, sometimes, you know, that's kind of mind-boggling to think of this small group of people who's, you know, some strong coalitional kinds of efforts with others really discovered that they did have some clout.
And now, we did rebuild the building on another location, and people in the community would say, well, Pastor Strelo or so-and-so, or every lay person they were talking with, once we see the building get up, we'll know you meant business. Well, I left before it finished, but we went back for the dedication, and they had 350 people. Now, not all those had joined, about 150 of them had, and at the dedication, the bishop stood up and basically said, it's a miracle. I don't understand how this happened.
So the lay president
of the congregation stood up and said, well, Bishop, I'm glad to see you're the only one who had the problem.
We knew all along
what we were doing, and if you had just listened to us, we would have been done a lot sooner. So I'm not saying this is the panacea or this is the ultimate. It's a penultimate way of churches participating in their own communities. It'll change the way you worship. It'll change the way you pray. It'll change the way you cross yourself, if you're inclined to do that. And it certainly changed the way a pastor views him or herself and the way a congregation views the pastor, as you were alluding to. Pushes the pastor much more into a pastoral priestly role, because the issues are brought, at least they were brought to me, by the people in the congregation.
And theological issues then come to the fore in a way that they don't when you're dealing just abstractly with things like love and all the other kinds of words that we use a lot in the church but don't always have the kind of concrete, gutsy meaning that they acquired in that situation.
QCO was started in 1976, still going. The campaign with the Port Authority was begun in 1978, and still going on.
Settlement was reached in 82.
In 82. So it was from 80 to 82 that the campaign with the Port Authority really was taken.
And when was the church dedicated?
Church was dedicated in 84. Took a long time from the village.
It's a whole nother story of building a church in New York City.
I never will sin in such a way again. But essentially, and the people are constantly changing, still learning. I think the thing about the Donald Manus discoveries, the QCO is really on to something. Eventually, the whole political apparatus of Queen City of Borough Hall fell apart, and Manus eventually committed suicide. But I remember one point he said, well, you people can't take you seriously, you can't turn out the vote. So in 3 days, we registered 10,000 people. Took them to him each stack, had the media come in, and he said, I hope these are all Democratic. But it's hard work. People have to give up watching television at night.